Josiah Bushnell Grinnell was a congressman, a minister, a sheep farmer, the founder of Grinnell the Town, the founder of Grinnell College, and a radical. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with a group of students from Grinnell College that has spent the semester exploring the life and beliefs of J.B. Grinnell. I'll talk with them about what they uncovered about his life, his works, and his legacy. We'll also talk about the anti-slavery movement that he was involved in and early efforts to create a system for higher education in Iowa with historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1854, Josiah Bushnell Grinnell arrived in Iowa with a plan to create a utopian community born out of the anti-slavery movement and a commitment to education. He became the founder of Grinnell, the town, and Grinnell College. This semester, a group of students at Grinnell has been exploring the life and beliefs of J.B. Grinnell. We'll start the hour focusing on what they've discovered. Then later in the hour, historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni will be here to help put the work of J.B. Grinnell into greater context in Iowa. And we have a lot of students with us today. We're going to start the hour with Grace Gallagher. Hello, Grace.
Hi.
Thank you for being here. And Daniel Kisslinger. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
And now both of you and the other students here today are part of a senior seminar focusing on J.B. Grinnell. Daniel, what was the goal of this seminar?
So that was something that we developed as a class, actually. Our professor, Keisha Scott, came in with a certain framework, but really it was something that we were able to take on and kind of mold ourselves. So we put together a list of kind of the takeaways that we wanted to bring out of the class, and that's kind of informed all the work we've done. So kind of to the framework that we really grabbed onto was the idea of dispelling the myths, both about the individual J.B. Grinnell, the formation of the college, the historical period and point that the town was founded in, and kind of this idea of this idyllic small town. What is the real kind of not dirt, but the history behind it? Dig a little bit deeper than just what's kind of in the promotional video and stuff like that. So as people coming and living there, you know, out of various parts all over the country, it's helped us kind of see the town in a different light and, of course, understand this historical figure differently.
And Grace, what is the culmination of all of this research? What is it all coming to now?
So in a week from today,
oh God,
which seems far too soon, we'll be putting on a school-wide production about J.B. Grinnell. It's sort of a multimedia, part live action, part filmed video, and it's going to be an exciting mix of comedy and drama and all of it being very historical and informative to the student body. The student body at Grinnell, I think maybe they know that Grinnell founded the college, but I don't think, before this class started, I didn't know anything else about him. I think a lot of the students assume he was a college president, which he wasn't.
Or a professor, academic of some sort, yeah.
So I think it's exciting to let the rest of the student body find out as much as we have. And it's exciting to share that everything that we've learned so far.
Well, as you broke down the different things to research about J.B. Grinnell, Grace, I know that you focused on his childhood. So give us a brief description of where he grew up and his early years.
All right. So he grew up in New Haven, Vermont, and he was an orphan pretty early on, but was raised by a neighbor. And he was self-taught and became a teacher at 16. And he went on to Yale, but was encouraged by a mentor to leave Yale and go to the Oneida Institute.
Yep.
And he started off there in 1841, I think, and graduated in 1843. But the school was so radical that the state of New York refused to issue the degrees. So he actually never got the degree. But I think his attendance at that school definitely were some very, very formative years for what was to come.
All right. So Oneida was known as a hotbed of radicalism. What was radicalism at that time?
That's different than
radicalism now, clearly.
For sure. And very different in different parts of the country, of course. So in terms of the framework of academics, most of the recognized academic institutions, such as Harvard or Yale or Columbia at the time, were still teaching kind of the classics. It was structured around philosophy, mathematics, and learning Greek and Latin, whereas Oneida was kind of it was a little bit more of a not practical education in the framework of learning skills, but it was reading some more current or more controversial philosophers, thinkers, and then more importantly than just reading their work, placing it within the framework of the sociocultural point that they were in at that point. So not just looking at history or ancient philosophy, but really examining with a critical eye the world around them. And I think that's something that definitely has transitioned and crossed over and has been kind of a – it was something he brought out to Iowa with him, definitely.
And at that time, part of the radicalness of yeah. Oneida was an abolitionist movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he also became a minister. When did that happen?
That was just shortly after graduating. He moved up just north of Albany and was at a congregation there. And I think in his autobiography, he describes how progressive this church was by describing that the African Americans could sit wherever they wanted in the church. So it was really early on that he had these ideas.
And that was what brought him down to Washington, D.C. Eventually, he wanted to make a move to be more involved in politics and moved to D.C. to become a congregational minister there, and had some really important experiences for him there. He talks also in the autobiography about one of the most important moments that kind of informed his life was seeing a family of slaves on the slave block being auctioned off. And first of all, there was a shock for him of seeing that. But then there was also, almost more importantly, this feeling of looking around and just feeling like the only sane person in a room full of crazy people, basically. Like, why is nobody saying anything? Why is this okay? Especially within the religious institution that's preaching understanding and equality to some degree, you know, at least in the rhetoric of the religion. For him, he thought that that was one of the most hypocritical things, was to stand in the pulpit and preach that, and then stand idly by while men and women were being sold. So that pushed him to become more, not just more radical, but more active in abolition, and also I think pushed him to get out of Washington, D.C.
What brought him to Iowa?
So he married sort of rich, and his wife had a lot of land in Missouri that he could have taken, but he was on a train to Missouri.
To survey the land.
And he got caught up in a confrontation with some slave hunters. And he got involved. And there was a railroad builder who was actually on the train as well, Henry Farnham. And Henry Farnham was really impressed and told Grinnell that he wouldn't be happy in Missouri because of their stance on slavery and essentially the blood on the land. And so he encouraged Grinnell to head to Iowa, where he would be building a railroad, because Grinnell understood the value of a railroad and what that could bring to a developing city.
The way that we framed it in class was, it was kind of like if all of a sudden you sat down next to Bill Gates on the train as you were going out to your first job, or Oprah, you know, having the right connection, you know, knowing the right person.
And so because he had this information about where the railroad was going to be built, that helped him make his decision about where in Iowa he wanted to settle?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he understood what the railroad could do for trade and bringing people out there.
The way that he envisioned it was Grinnell, the town, as the center point between the East-West Railroad and the North-South Railroad, because there was a lot of talk in building a transcontinental railroad between also having one that ran, if not all the way north through what's now Canada, at least across the United States from, you know, the northern border down. So he kind of imagined geographically the town of Grinnell sitting at the center point. Obviously, didn't exactly come to fruition.
So close.
Yeah. But that was the strategy, and saw the potential, both in terms of economy, but also in terms of thinkers. He was trying to transplant a certain intellectual model out to a part of the country that didn't really have an institution. And he saw the potential of the railroad being a vehicle to bring that to this geographical place.
All right. So we know that he's a minister. We know that he is an intellectual. We know that he's an abolitionist. He's also a sheep farmer. Where does that come into play?
You want to take this one? You're the expert on the sheep.
We have a great video that we shot for next week. We had some great sheep costumes. Anyways, he had 2,000 sheep, and I think a good story is that one of the first times he met Lincoln, Lincoln just knew him as the sheep farmer from Iowa.
And Abraham Lincoln,
yeah,
the president.
But he also used that as part of his cover for helping in the Underground Railroad. Grinnell was at the center of Iowa's network in the Underground Railroad, and he referred in his correspondence when moving slaves from one state or runaway slaves from one free spot to another, one safe haven, as fleeces of wool.
But he was a very successful sheep farmer, was he not?
Yeah.
I mean, he became the head of the Iowa Wool Growers Association. So he seemed to be very involved as a farmer, as well as all of these other things.
Yeah, I mean, among more than anything else, really, he was a man who saw opportunity. And that was the sphere in which he saw the potential to move forward in developing both his own stature and everything like that, but also the economy of the town. So he saw the potential for it. And whether it was that or the railroads or, you know, building a college or all the other, you becoming a congressman, all the, you know, whether the political things that he ended up backing, he saw the potential for growth. And he kind of grabbed onto it, and some of that was his intense devotion to wool, if you can put it that way.
So we, in Iowa, we like to rewrite history a little bit because there was an active Underground Railroad here,
right.
And a lot of us like the fact that we were on the right side of history. But can you paint me a little more complex picture, Grace, of the anti-slavery movement in Iowa? I mean, although this was never a slave state, this was not a state that was 100% devoted to the abolitionist cause.
Yeah. When Grinnell met John Brown, he faced
the
a lot of opposition.
Abolitionist.
Yeah, the famous abolitionist. He faced a lot of opposition. And I think people were out to find him, out to get Grinnell even.
He was called the most dangerous man in Iowa by pro-slavery writings.
And there were even people who wanted to assassinate him.
Yeah, there were a couple assassination attempts. One of the people who's going to come up a little bit later in the show knows some more information about that. But that was a big part of what was going on. You know, this was not clear cut. There was opposition, even in this, you know, utopian town that he'd created. It was not a singular idea about slavery.
All right. Well, thank you both for being here today. We're going to swap out students that are part of this seminar now. So Grace Gallagher, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
And Daniel Kisslinger, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This hour, we're talking about the life of J.B. Grinnell, the founder of Grinnell the Town, the founder of Grinnell College. And we'll also be focusing on this historical period in greater context a little later in the hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're focusing on the life of Josiah Bushnell Grinnell. He was the founder of the town Grinnell, the founder of Grinnell College, of course. He came to Iowa in 1854 in hopes of creating a utopian community that was born out of the anti-slavery movement and a commitment to education. We've also discovered that he was a minister and a sheep farmer and many other things about him so far. I'm talking with students who participated in a senior seminar, are still participating in a senior seminar at Grinnell, focusing on the life of J.B. Grinnell. It was called J.B. Grinnell, Man, Myths, and Magnificent, and their work will be culminating in a performance next Tuesday afternoon at 4:15 at Harris Cinema on the Grinnell College campus. And with me now are Allison Miller. Hello, Allison.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Morgan Kissinger. Hello, Morgan.
Hello there.
Thank you so much for being here. And Laura Huerta. Hello, Laura.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today as well. And so when exactly was Grinnell the college founded? You don't have to give me a year, I guess. But he came to Iowa with the idea of starting this community. How quickly was he able to get the college going?
He got it going pretty quickly. I know that when he came to Iowa, he elevated in status very quickly. He actually, by 1868, and he came around maybe 1864 or so, I know that he was able to participate in the 6th General Assembly for Congress, for the Congress of Iowa, and that was when his status kind of led itself to help out, and that was when the college began, or that's when he started to...
The college wasn't always in Grinnell. I was originally in eastern Iowa and then moved to Grinnell, Iowa, a little further west. But he was actually afraid of losing the college during the Civil War. He was afraid that a lot of the students at the school were so devoted to the cause that they would leave and then there would be nothing left. So he had to persuade some professors and students to stay in order to keep the college going during the conflict in the United States.
Well, and we were talking earlier about how the anti-slavery movement was not a universal movement in the state of Iowa. And even within the town of Grinnell, Laura, not everyone in the town of Grinnell was involved in abolition or the anti-slavery movement, right?
Most definitely, yes. He had two assassination attempts, and I think Allison is more of an expert on that, and she can talk about that. But there was a divide, definitely. Not everyone in Iowa or in the town was supportive of Grinnell, and we will be able to see that in the production next week.
Yeah.
So who wanted to kill him?
Well, two different groups of people. First, the first assassination attempt was by the Knights of the Golden Circle, which was a pro-slavery group in Iowa that had actually two members of the group had drafted the dodged the draft to fight on the Union Army, and Grinnell found this unacceptable, and so he and some of his colleagues went out to find the draft dodgers and bring them back and hopefully have them fight for the Union Army. And during this event, Grinnell was also speaking in an area in southern Iowa, and two Knights of the Golden Circle actually killed one of JB's associates and then attempted to shoot him as well. And he describes barely dodging. He perhaps a little dramatically in his autobiography, says just he narrowly missed the bullets and rode off on his horse. So
we talked briefly in the last segment about the fact that he had an encounter with Abraham Lincoln. What was the context for that encounter?
Well, before that, actually, kind of relating to the divide for slavery, when he was trying to. When he was running for Congress in Iowa, he had his stance was very anti-slavery, and not everyone supported that. And so he was actually trying to have correspondence with Lincoln and have him come to Iowa and support him and show how alike he is with Lincoln. But Lincoln responded and said he was unable to come, but he has his full support. And then from there, so what was your question again?
Well, I was just asking for the context that he encountered Abraham Lincoln.
So then they did actually meet then once J.B. Grinnell was elected and he was in Washington, D.C. when they met.
Yeah, they never actually met in Iowa.
Right.
I think, like Grace may have mentioned earlier, Abraham's first impressions of J.B. were that he was a sheep farmer and just asking him how things were going in Iowa. But I think one of the really important things that we're trying to bring out in our presentation is that J.B. was a little bit more progressive than Lincoln. Lincoln didn't always agree with what J.B.'s stance was on things. And I don't want to say they butted heads, but J.B. tried to push Lincoln to take a more progressive approach. And that's what actually caused a lot of his trouble. His second assassination attempt was on the steps of Congress by a fellow congressman named General Rousseau from Kentucky, and they got into this conflict about the Freedmen's Bureau. And there was witnesses saying that if J.B. had tried to So the plan was that Rousseau was going to sneak attack J.B. Grinnell on the steps of Congress and beat him physically. He also had a pistol with him, and he was also 6 feet tall and 200 pounds, so he had the weight and size advantage over Grinnell. And if Grinnell tried to resist in any physical way, Rousseau is quoted as saying that he was going to attempt to assassinate him. And so they met on the steps of Congress, and Rousseau basically taunted him.
Yeah, let him have it.
And beat him over the head with an iron cane. And J.B. Grinnell refused to fight back in any physical way and is said to have told Rousseau that he only defends himself in debate and with his words. So,
and it was kind of a lose-lose situation for Grinnell there, because not only did he get beat up on the steps of Congress, but then he wasn't reelected for Congress the next term around. And they're not sure about why, but part of it, I believe public sentiment was that they didn't really want a coward representing them, because he didn't fight back. But from JB's point of view, if he fought back, he would have, I mean, they would have tried to kill him.
So he became involved in state government. He became involved in the federal government as a congressman. He was also, as we mentioned earlier, a very successful sheep farmer. When he founded Grinnell College, how involved was he with the school, Laura?
He wasn't involved that much, actually. That was all left up to the teachers and the professors. I think he had a vision, and he wanted other people's input into that vision for the town and the college itself. As Grace and Daniel mentioned earlier, he wasn't a president. He wasn't a professor. He was more of a big picture sort of man. And so, yeah.
He definitely left his legacy on Grinnell, though. Grinnell today is definitely seen as a very progressive school with a focus on social justice, which I think was what JB had envisioned when he created the college.
So after spending a semester studying this man and studying the times in which he lived and the movements in which he was involved, what are you taking away from what you've found? I mean, you know about J.B. Grinnell now, but what else, what greater lessons have you learned, do you think?
I think it's interesting to look at how this local history can be summed up and looked at it as about American history. And so we took a look at in American studies, we like to look at the particular and connect it to the whole. And so the particular here would be J.B. Grinnell, and the whole would be America. And so by studying this one man, we can take a look at all these historical events and the context in which it happened, and how he was able to be a light, or be this progressive figure before a lot of other people were at the point where he was.
It's also really interesting to see the contradictions with J.B. Grinnell. Yeah. We focus a lot on how progressive he was during the abolitionist movement and the anti-slavery movement, but he took a much different stance when it came to Native Americans, and didn't really care that he was encroaching on their land.
Can you give me an example of what his beliefs were with regard to Native Americans?
His legislation wasn't focused on Native Americans a lot, but he definitely didn't equate them on the same level as blacks or whites in the United States, and didn't understand or respect their land rights.
I just think he didn't think of them on equal ground. He thought of them as drunks, or and he was very against alcohol, and so that was something that he parted ways with.
Well, and in your slideshow that you've put together about this, there's a quote from him about how young Native Americans need to be educated in modern educational mm-hmm. systems, because he says that the savages had, I can't remember the exact quote, the savages hadn't ever contributed anything to our society. So in looking at that side of him, how do you reconcile that with his anti-slavery views? And did he believe in equality for African Americans?
That's one of the things that we're studying, and one of the things that we can see in the seminar as a whole. We set out to look at his life and study what he was really about. And so we constantly go back and forth in the class trying to see how he was so anti-slavery, yet he had such a different stance on Native Americans. And I think he believed that they didn't really contribute much to the country and they were sort of uncivilized. So how can he be both at the same time and be so of a pioneer and a great visionary for the country in Iowa and the college? But he was also involved in like shady dealings with like the railroad and the Native Americans. And, you know, we're also missing women's voices in the overall picture. So,
well, and there are many, many people who were involved in abolition who did not believe that blacks were equal to whites. Do you have evidence for his beliefs on that front?
J.B. Grinnell was one of the few congressmen that advocated for arming blacks in the Union Army. He helped pass legislation that would create equal pay for sailors, black sailors, and black soldiers. And it was also with the Freedmen's Bureau, equal education opportunity was huge for him. It's hard to say whether he necessarily believed they were on an equal playing field. You can be progressive for the 1860s and still not carry the same stance that we do today. But he definitely took a more progressive approach than I think Lincoln did and a lot of his fellow colleagues.
Morgan and Allison, the two of you are Iowans, and so let's put this in context of Iowa history as well. Does this change what you think about the state of Iowa, what you've learned about J.B. Grinnell?
I think it's interesting to see kind of how innovative J.B. has been for the state of Iowa as a whole. His education policies were – it's not constricted just to Grinnell College, because when he was on the Iowa Congress, he advocated for free public schools and for every – I think it was every town with 200-plus people needed a school. And so that's something that kind of affected me, having public schools that are free. And, granted, it's a nationwide thing, but I didn't know about J.B. Grinnell before coming to college or anything like that, but his legacy kind of lived on.
I think it's really interesting because the seminars kind of taught me that a small town's history is not insignificant, and that I'm from Des Moines, Iowa, and I didn't really know anything about Grinnell before I came to school here. And it shows that small town history is Iowa history, and Iowa history is American history, and this is a figure that we at least believe should be known and studied, and we think made a huge impact on the discourse of American history.
In spending this much time focusing on one individual that obviously had a great deal of impact in Iowa and in this part of Iowa, Laura, does it change your perspective about what an individual can do and can accomplish?
Oh, most definitely it does. Studying his life has made me see the power of the most mundane and insignificant, or what would be considered the most mundane and insignificant sort of details. This man is not known, and he should be known. And there are so many things that we could say on the air or in the production that we don't even have time to say. But there is definitely a lot that one person can do. As we can see, JB was involved in so much more than just the anti-slavery movement. And I think that had to do a lot with his belief in himself and his visions. And he spoke a lot about what the land could bring, what one man could bring, what just a few individuals could bring. Of course, it wasn't just JB on his own. He had a lot of support from a lot of great figures, national figures, but also the smaller figures as well. So
I think it's very telling of the people who lived in Iowa as well. Mm-hmm. Individuals are important, and they can do a lot to shape history, but they aren't anything without the people that are backing them. And while we had discussed earlier, not everybody was as progressive as Grinnell or supported the abolition of slavery, but he was able to convince enough people, and enough people believed the same way that he did, to support him. I think that's really telling of the state.
Now, of course, he wasn't acting alone. Did you also study some of the people that he interacted with in Iowa that were also part of this movement? Or was this focused mostly on him?
It was mostly focused on JB, definitely.
So you have your performance coming up next week, and you can just give us a brief preview, but how have you taken the life of J.B. Grinnell and turned it into a performance that you can share with your fellow students so they get an idea of who this man was?
Well, a lot of what we're focusing on are the big stories, the interesting facts. And so we've tried to put together a bunch of videos where we play J.B. Grinnell, or we play sheeps that are dressed up, and we try to show off just how important Grinnell is so that we need to spread the word to our college and to the neighboring communities.
What is one thing, Allison, that you want people to know about J.B. Grinnell out of this?
I think I want people to understand a lot of our audience is probably going to be college students, and I think I want the college students to get a better understanding of who this man was, who was this man that founded the college, and what did he do in addition to founding the college? What were his impacts? What role did he play on the national stage? And hopefully we can get a few laughs out of it. It was the autobiographies and biographies were perhaps not the most interesting pieces of literature to read, so we tried to make it a pretty fun twist and make things humorous, which I think will be entertaining.
Allison Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laura Huerta, thank you.
Thank you.
And Morgan Kissinger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to talk with historian Tom Moraine in a moment about the time period that J.B. Grinnell came to Iowa in and the other people who were founding institutes of higher education at the time. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And with me now is historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni. He has filled many roles in Iowa over the years, including director of history at Living History Farms and administrator of the State Historical Society. And one of my favorite guests. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Welcome back to the show.
It is snowing in extreme, extreme southern Iowa. We are not happy.
We'll try to do better next week, at least. Tom, we've been talking, of course, about J.B. Grinnell this hour, but he was just one of many who came to Iowa. And really, there was a group of people that came to Iowa that really wanted to shape the political views and the culture of Iowa in a very material way. A lot of people coming here from the northeastern United States.
Yes, and I really like the students' use of the individual to illustrate the larger trends. And for that, Grinnell is a wonderful example of what I would think of as one of the three major groups that were sort of impacting, coming to Iowa and shaping who we are. One of those groups, as you've mentioned, was the New England influence. Through the Congregational and Conservative Presbyterian wings of their churches. Another group were the Southerners who were coming up from the Upper South, southern parts of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, and moving up the Mississippi and settling primarily in the southern part. And then the immigrants coming in from Germany, Ireland, Scandinavia. And those three groups had to make their accommodations with each other. Grinnell is an almost perfect example of the New England group. And I think the group you're referring to, that influential group, there were a group of seminary students, congregational seminary students from New England, Andover Theological Seminary, and they, upon graduation, said, "We're going to make the West a missionary field." Like many other missionaries were doing at the time, they need churches, they need schools, and we're going to go out and make that area our missionary field and found churches in the West. They call themselves the Iowa Band, and there were about 12 of them who came to Iowa together and each picked out a different town to try to create a church and open a school there.
And J.B. Grinnell was not an original member of the Iowa Band, but he did associate with these people when he came to Iowa.
He was congregational. And he was about 6 years younger than this group, but it would have been it would not have been surprising at all if he had been at Andover the time the other 12 were there. He would have said, "This is me too." He had a very good business head in addition to that, as it's been pointed out, but he had a very strong religious conviction. And that New England element said, ours is a superior vision. We need to establish the moral climate of the community. We need to impose our vision of community, of morality, on the communities. And they took that very seriously. So they became active in reform movements in politics. And Grinnell is a wonderful example of that.
And of course, we mentioned how he was hoping to sort of found this utopian community in Iowa, or at least to turn a town into a utopian community in Iowa. And Iowa seemed to be a place that attracted a lot of people who had these visions for mini utopias. What do you think it was about the state of Iowa that attracted these people and made them consider Iowa something of a blank slate, something that could be turned into what they wanted?
Well, Iowa was a blank slate when the land went up for sale, as was much of the prairie states and the Great Plains. This was a place that you could go out and you could start your own community. You couldn't necessarily keep other people out, but the first people there could decide what kind of a community it was going to be and make it unwelcome for later comers. Grinnell happened to attract both New Englanders and Southerners, and at the point that the New Englanders said, we're going to integrate our schools racially, the Southerners protested, and there was a race riot over that. Here again, using Grinnell as a focal point, you see that tension that was in early Iowa. But if one group dominates at the beginning, they sort of shape the flavor for other later arrivals. And if you don't like that particular flavor, you can pick another town that's closer to you. So it was sort of a Darwinian morality that follows the creation of different Iowa towns.
This group that came from New England valued their religion. They valued their own moral code and were hoping to impose it on many towns in Iowa. But there was also this valuing of education. What were their educational goals?
Yes, and that's a very important aspect of the division within the religious community, again, which Grinnell and the Congregationalists and Presbyterians represent. Here, education of the theological, the importance of getting the theology right and being very particular and learned in your biblical interpretations and the knowledge of Greek to be able to read original scriptural passages and so forth, that was an important part of the education, whereas groups like the Methodist, the Baptist, they would recruit ministers and preachers from the general population, and they were more of an emotional approach. They weren't as concerned with the particulars, and they were much more successful than the Congregationalists. The Methodists, Baptists were well adapted to the frontier, where if you need a highly educated minister in order to give your sermons, your preacher pool is much smaller. And as a result, Iowa tended to be more on the evangelical side in terms of the church population and conversions than it was for the New England educated clergy. One good example of that, William Salter was a member of the Iowa band, and in his diary once he wrote, "Today I preached my first sermon that I wrote west of the Mississippi." For 6 months, he had been reading sermons that he wrote as a seminary student back in New England, and he would read these to his audience. Oh, dear. But the Methodists or Baptists would preach as the Spirit moved them, but they didn't have the theological precision that the Congregationalists insisted on.
Right, but they may have made up for it with a little bit of fire and enthusiasm.
That's right. That's right. And they were much more likely to speak in an idiom of the people who had moved to the frontier. But here again, Grinnell is an excellent example, and I commend the students for picking up on how he can be used to illustrate larger trends.
As I mentioned earlier this hour, you know, as Iowans, when we look at Iowa history, we tend to embrace the positives and eliminate the negatives often when we think about ourselves and what our state is. But we have always been very proud of public education in the state of Iowa and the literacy rate in Iowa and our focus on excellence in education in this state. Was this the beginning of that culture in Iowa?
It's an interesting story in Iowa education, and today we don't understand a challenge that they had. We believed, and most early Iowa settlers coming in family units wanted education for their children. We were settled in family units, and farm families wanted their children to be educated, and very quickly we established that uniform system of one-room schools that kids could walk to. And we had a very high percentage of literacy and good education through the one-room school. But then the colleges were founded next. We had many churches starting colleges, like the Congregationalists with the Iowa College that became Grinnell College, and Iowa private colleges go back with this tradition of their denominations wanting to educate clergy, wanting to find a place that their children could get a good classical education. But what we left out was that part in the middle that said, okay, I've now graduated from my one-room school. How do I get ready for college? So the system of the secondary schools, the high schools, they had a problem. They had to figure out where to pick up students when they left off the one-room school, but also get them ready for when they went to college. So that high school had a real challenge of meshing at both ends. And that's a story that is a triumph, in fact, for the public education, that they could modulate the educational process here and pick them up when they left one and get them into the next one and sort of a uniform system. So the Iowa colleges and the University of Iowa and the Regents institutions were developed before we had a good secondary system, and we had to sort of do a makeshift procedure of how to make it integrated from kindergarten up through a college BA degree.
Oh, that's so interesting. There had been historically in many places for people who wanted, in the United States, for people who wanted to go on to a secondary education, they had to leave their homes. They had to go to boarding schools or travel to different places. And so in creating a system of public education in Iowa that allowed students to go on to a secondary education, was there a rubric that we could follow?
Nope. It was sort of make it up as you go along. In the 1870s, the legislature created the possibility for towns of a certain size to create high schools. But first, we were talking about county high schools. And as you said, people from the outlying parts of the county might have to live in the town and go to school and maybe go home on weekends or something like that. But we simply didn't have the capability for a country school to expand to a high school. It didn't have the numbers of students that it were going to need, or the trained personnel. It was far too expensive for a neighborhood to establish a high school. So it really wasn't until the creation of the introduction of the Model T Ford in the teens, when students could live at home and get into school and get back. They would have to come to a public high school, or there were a lot of academies, private schools that would fill in that secondary system so they could get ready for that college entrance level.
So would Iowa have been one of the leaders in this push for secondary education?
Yes, I think we were. I haven't done a comparative study of that. I've done it within Iowa, but we, thanks in part to that strong New England component, we had an education lobby, as it were, that was saying education is important, and we have always had that strong strong component coming from that ethnic or regional population that has promoted education. And here, Grinnell is an excellent example of that. So congratulations to the students for picking up on that.
Well, and Tom, we're nearly out of time, and we have talked about this on the program before. But again, we talked a great deal about how J.B. Grinnell was involved in the abolitionist movement, in the anti-slave movement, and that was a strong movement in the state of Iowa. How big a part is that of our state and of our history?
The abolitionists before the Civil War were really a small minority. The number of Iowans who were actively working for the freedom of the slaves was not a big component. Lincoln was not a big component, and Republicans were a accumulation of several different groups, but among those, abolitionists were probably very small. As the war went on, the disgust with slavery and understanding how slavery supported the Southern cause, abolitionists grew, and the realization that the Civil War had to put an end to slavery developed through the war, but it was not there at the start of the war. One of the concerns was if any state in the North has liberal racial policies and seems to be welcoming blacks or freed slaves, the fear was that then it would become a magnet. So states, in some sense, were almost competing with each other to be hostile, to keep out migration of Southern blacks. The attraction in Iowa, of course, was free land, and by the end of the Civil War, a lot of the good land was gone, so we were not the attraction by the 1860s or 70s to new groups moving in that we had been when there was free land.
So when we like to rewrite history, Iowa was never a slave state, but that doesn't mean that this was a place where no one believed in slavery.
Yeah, we had people who would be just fine with letting slavery exist where it existed, because then we wouldn't have to deal with the racial issue. They were saying, hands off, that's a Southern problem, we don't want to do that. After the Civil War, we had to confront the racial issue. And Iowa had some strong marks going for it, particularly through the courts. But we were also the first state in 1868 to grant suffrage to both whites and blacks, and that by a majority vote of the people. So Iowans, at least those who could vote, meaning white males, did by a majority grant the vote to black males.
You know, Tom, I think one of the most interesting things about thinking about J.B. Grinnell and the others who came with him from New England to Iowa is we've talked a lot about the immigrants who came to Iowa from all over the world that shaped this state. But this is a truly American influence.
Well, it's New England, yeah. Sometimes by way of Ohio and Illinois and Indiana, their grandparents came from New England, or their great grandparents came from New England, and Americans in the 19th century tended to settle with people who were like them, particularly in the small towns. So the climate, the moral climate, the educational climate, the business climate tended to be, you found a town that suited you. So we had those, we were less a melting pot than we were a place where people could settle with like-minded fellow immigrants.
Tom, thank you so much.
Good, thank you.
Historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, author Karen Thompson Walker of The Age of Miracles. This is Talk of Iowa.